Good evening, everybody. I'm very excited for this evening. I think these Wednesday writing groups must be my favorite part of the Gloucester Writers' Center. The women's writing group I inherited from Charlie Bianchini, who started it at the very beginning of the writers' group, of the Writers' Center, with members who are still here today as part of our group. Is it 5, 6 years now that it's been 6 years that it's been going on? And it keeps growing and changing and is one of the most inclusive and generous groups you'll ever find. On any given day, you'll find writing about the Bible, horror erotica, stories about healing, autobiographical work, general fiction, mystery, and poetry on any given day. The thing that I love most about this group is how inclusive it is and how in this room everybody is encouraged to use their voice to say everything they need to say in a safe, comfortable place and to push each other forward into those little places that are a little bit uncomfortable or into those places where you need to go to grow. It's a very helpful group in that way. And the feedback that the women give each other is absolutely wonderful. And the support through about writing and about life has been... makes my tummy feel good. I don't know how else to say it. It's one of the best feelings. So I'm very, very excited about this. And we have, from our group Mining the Hat, the sole remaining man. We had a second Wednesday morning group that was formed out of the open mic, out of a need for a writer's group, for a group of men who were working together to write poetry and short prose and songs and to have a place that allowed them much of what the women offered each other. And unfortunately, many of them got jobs that that interfered with their coming on Wednesday morning. So our group has diminished, but is no less powerful. So I think what we'll do is I will call everybody up, either from here or from the seat, and we'll just hear what we have to offer. And thank you all so much for coming and for supporting the Writers' Center. First up, we have Jody Stewart, who is, I think, the heartbeat of this group.
That's a lot of pressure. Okay, well, I have my lucky earrings on, and somehow I still had to go first. So is my fly down or anything before I sit? Can I just move this here?
Yes.
Okay. I did want to take a minute because I wanted to say thanks to Amanda. She's put in tireless hours, and there's a lot of hard-won smiles around here, but thanks, Amanda. And to the Writer Center for the place that we put this microphone. And also Sally for always encouraging me and listening, even when I don't want to talk. I appreciate that. Okay. Unfortunately, I haven't really been writing as much as I would love, so I went back to October 2015, and I found an assignment Amanda gave us, and I just chose this one because if I didn't, I'd probably still be home waiting to find which one I wanted. So here we are. This is called A Can of Creamed Corn. So you ask, what landed me in AA? My sponsor said I'd have to tell my story, said it would help me cope, said it would help others. I can't say that I'm convinced, but for the sake of the 12 steps and a sharp memory that won't be still, here goes. It was December, near that always dreaded holiday, 1986. There was snow on the ground, not enough to really bother anybody. Bitter temperature and ice, however, were a hassle. Getting to the liquor store was a slippery process, especially when the shakes switched over control of my hands. I'd often comment to the clerk while trying to steady the tremors, shame talking. It was just the cold. When I think back, I'm surprised that I felt humiliation, anything for that matter, aside from a singular drilling need. I'd hit bottom many months before, but stayed there convinced there was no way out. I gave it all for that one thing. In my former life, I had amounted to a high school math teacher. I had lost my job in a minute of angry, drunken shouts. After the basics and the bottles, the money from unemployment fell short. Every time I wondered how or when my life would shift, I drank that small voice into a slurring goodbye. More than once, I'd found myself waking up by the door, bloody, nearly ruined somewhere, without a memory. Sometimes worse. It's hard to think about. I still wonder. Maybe I was on my way to the back bedroom to sleep it off, or heading for the local down the street. Like I said, it was all a slurring goodbye. My existence at this time was hinged on my morning near-unconscious trip to the corner bottle shop. On this particular morning, I'd scraped puke from my unshaven, shrunken face and traded my shirt for a lesser smell. A pair of basketball shorts clung uneven to a withered frame. I was shaking so hard I couldn't tie the laces on my boots, which were far too heavy on my feet. I don't know how I functioned. Picture it. I'm near 6 feet. Can't be too minimal at that height. The stream of people sharing the sidewalk stayed clear. To be truthful, I was a stumbling, sliding, shake, then stumble again spectacle. The sun, dim as it was, seemed to glare straight through my eyes, like a big black car slamming the brakes, screeching into a wall. Shorts, unfitting for the cold in my thin form, untied boots and a ripped-up stain for a shirt, a bullseye for stares and whispers. I had managed to cover my head with a black stocking cap. Honestly, it wasn't against the cold that I thought of it. I had a mission and didn't usually notice the bite in the air so much on these morning trips. It was in a lame attempt to cover my hair, matted dreadlocks that hung to my shoulders and smelled like yesterday's half-digested beef stew. I just needed the bottle. That day, the funds were lower than usual. Fleshman's would have to do. I thought of next week when I could have the Jamesons I preferred, easier on the stomach. That's where my attention began. I hadn't planned anything. It just happened. At least that's what I told the cop. Addiction doesn't accept limits, doesn't throw in the towel, and wins nearly every time. Then something happened, setting off the chain of events and bad decisions. I was close to my destination. All I could think of was that first long sip, my hands steady, my gut warm, and the place in between misery. Stumbling along fences, parking meters, and street signs, I suddenly felt that black car smash into the wall. Bile pushed up my throat. My stomach lurched like the ground was set out on high seas. I bent over, hurling the liquid contents so violently I fell forward. The bones in my knees actually made an odd hollow clunk that I could hear move briefly past me. As I struggled to get up, a young blonde stopped. I never did look her straight in the face. My gaze stayed on the indent of both hands in the frozen snow. She grabbed me up. Kind, I thought. I wanted to thank her, but instead a jumbled gurgle was all she got. Suddenly angry, I pulled away, deciding I got nothing to prove to anyone. She hurried on. I shuffled my sad ass, moving again in my daily circle. I finally heard the bell as I pushed open Magruder's door. This place, smelling like pine and stale beer, was empty except for one other guy. I don't know why I remember this, but his clothes, unlike mine, seemed shrunk from the wash. I didn't need to search. I knew my poison, the size of the bottle, and its place on the shelf. I felt myself half smile, moving towards the register, my shuffle a bit quicker. The Indian guy nodded his head. He knew me. He knew my pattern, my sickness. He bagged. My mouth sour, watered while I reached into my pocket. My shorts fell down slightly as I groped around for money. The man held the neck of the bottle wrapped in the familiar tall brown bag. Dark eyes, angry and aggravated. He'd seen this routine before. Poor slob, plays on his emotions and promises to pay later. That wasn't the case. It was gone. My father gave me that wallet. That bitch took it. Look, I mumbled, giving the clerk exactly what he expected. I'm in here every day. She stole my wallet, I stuttered, watching him place the package under the counter and frown at me. Look, man, I really need this. Please, I'll come back. I will. I heard myself pleading, and I couldn't stop. His plump finger pointed to the door with one word. "Out," he shouted. The gates of hell must have opened, because just then I felt heat burning in my chest. I hit another low, like someone, probably the blonde, scraped out a large part of my soul along with my wallet. I wanted her dead. It was almost as if a gust of wind carried me. I don't remember the DTs. I do remember standing outside, suddenly freezing cold, arms crossed, looking up and down, no blonde. I couldn't think for a moment. I could hardly breathe. I needed a drink, and quick. A thought burst into my head. I could panhandle. I wiped snot from my nose and talked myself out of that idea. Begging for change never worked out. The most I ever got was about $2 and a few, "Get a job, you fucking drunk." That's when decision one struck, like a hammer blow. I settled on robbing the liquor store. A small, rational part of me was still sober. I couldn't rob Magruder's. The guy knew me. I wouldn't make it far of that much, I was completely sure. In an instant, another idea polluted my desperate head. The car wash. I'd robbed the car wash. In my craze, I thought, it's still early, all those young punks. Not a lot of customers, but the cash drawer. I smirked, thinking maybe yesterday's receipts would still be waiting for deposit. Maybe I'd get lucky. Arms folded, head down, I walked. The power of my twisted plot propelled every step. I felt this weird feeling like I was no more than a pawn in a chess game, the opposing forces of Jesus and Satan. I can't imagine what people saw as I slid my way to go rob a place. Just doesn't matter, I guess. I shook with the dry heaves and continued, passing the dry cleaners. I saw my reflection. I saw my father in that window. I also saw a woman looking at me with disgust. The car wash was less than 2 blocks when I slid one last time and landed square on my ass, looking up and across the street at a place called Holmes Market, and no shit, there in the parking lot was the thief. Miraculously, I got up and ran. Ask me how? I couldn't tell you. Soaked shorts slapped against my legs. My physical body shook and groaned, but I only missed a couple steps. I somehow righted myself and chased her down. It hadn't occurred to me right then, but I was so focused. Chasing her in that bottle so hard, not sickness, ice, not traffic, nothing stopped me. I reached the parking lot, which had a good number of cars and people. "Hey, you!" She actually turned around. Bad idea to yell. Ah, hindsight, you know. She moved, pushing a full cart. I caught up. Ask me how? I couldn't tell you. I grabbed the end of the cart and we literally danced around the parking lot, me yelling profanities so loud I later lost my voice. For whatever reason, I remember the white lines of parking spaces blurring and her eyes, scared shitless. She said nothing. I ripped that stocking cap off my head, pulling some clumps out with it. A person I no longer recognized grabbed at the food in the cart, throwing full force, missing every time. At some point, I heard a loud smash. It stopped me long enough to look away. I'd thrown a can of string beans, maybe peas, and guess what? I smashed a windshield. Seriously, it wasn't an old family station wagon or a beat-up rusted pickup. It was a Lexus. I felt my heart sink in that moment. The rage in me exploded into rhythms and waves that I could not withdraw. I grabbed another can, pretty sure it was creamed corn, and proceeded to smash every window in the parking lot until I could no longer stand. I didn't hear the sirens. Funny thing, but I saw and recognized the lights. The girl long gone, I sat there in my wet, filthy place, trembling, bloody hands held out, a motion picture inside my head. I saw everything that I ever was. In a second so small, like the splitting of an atom, a chain reaction began. It occurred, or was placed into my realm of knowing. I was chasing my addiction, like I was chasing a lost friend, a family pet, I don't know, like it was something that I loved, you know? I was arrested, of course. My lever wrung out and hung to dry in the 90-day stay. Flushing my saturated being wasn't the easiest thing, but it happened, whether I begged for it to stop or not. It had to hurt, so I could feel. What I understood is that I wanted the clarity that sobriety partnered. I now chase life, simplicity, making peace as hard as I did the blonde, the bottle, and what would have been my demise. I now chase something that I do love, something strong enough to keep me from backing down. It is a constant. The demand doesn't pass. It is always there inside of me. I stand by what I said. Addiction doesn't accept limits, doesn't throw in the towel, and wins nearly every time. Even so, there is something in the timing, the circumstance, most times beyond terrible, that just may be what pushes you to break out a window or two to get to the other side. Timing that turns you around even if you don't want it, granting you a win, then another, then four, or more until you wake up on the other side of 10 years. I'd like to think that girl, a.k.a. my wake-up call, used whatever was in my wallet for a greater need, for a need greater than my own. A couple of kids said, a small burden lifted. I'm okay with that.
Next up, we have Elizabeth Enfield.
I just want to say, this is sort of like, I don't know what the New Yorker used to have. I thought it was Man in the Street, but I think it was called The Streets of New York. It was like in the front of the magazine, and there was always a writer who would just walk the city and just tell stories. Remember that? I think, I don't know if it's still a column. So this is just some, one of those from Gloucester. And that's the same kind of theme anyway. I'm more of an outsider. After 4 p.m., the senior center was locked, the bench outside the building occupied by three drunks. A tanned woman coiffed in a bright red wig, straight cut below her shoulders, minded them. They were talking in slurs, and I asked her if she needed help. She pointed to one of them and said he needed a drink of water. Hearing her, he said, yeah, yeah, I need a drink. I knew he didn't mean water. Are you hungry? I asked. Yep, he said. His eyes were different sizes, one shutting down. Their skin color of the men was a purplish red. I told her, I'll get him a cup of water and from Dunkin' Donuts. And she said, no, that's okay, I'll get it. Looking back at my unlocked car, a brown and white baby seagull was walking around my car hood looking for food. He hopped, jumped on, and flew onto the car, waiting to be fed. Friendly, he moved forward, unafraid. He just sat there. I knew this was probably a multifaceted repeat performance he knew by heart. Sliding to the front seat, I selected my lunch, a few last pieces of chicken. Getting out, I made a motion with my arm, pretending to throw a piece into the air. My brown and white feathery fellow, trying to grab it, was outdone by an older seagull. I thought it might be its mother. I went back and forth to get more pieces. I threw them to the younger bird until there was only one large bone left. I flung it directly to him, knowing gulls swallowed their food in one gulp. He dropped his head inquisitively, pecking at it and clamping onto it with his beak. The older bird walked away. Once more, he dropped his head to peck at the bits of meat clinging to the bone. Suddenly, the large white seagull stole it, flying with it into the air, landing a distance away, claiming his prize. The baby gull let out a caw, an admonishing screech at the thief, perhaps the parent of the smaller bird. The waif scooted off before the older gull got too close to him. The woman came over as her friend tried the door handle on the passenger side of my car. Don't you touch that car. It's not yours and you aren't allowed in. I got to my door, making sure the locks were on. He was still outside. I'd had the motor running. I shut it off. What does he want? I asked her. Oh, he wants to go for a ride, she replied. I thought he was trying to grab my purse, I said. These men were really gone, very drunk, incapable of doing anything except sitting, bleary-eyed, on the bus stop bench. He headed back for the bench. He was her cousin, she said. Give me my drink. I asked for a drink, he yelled annoyingly, laughing at me. I thought here was a center helping seniors with their health, recreation, trips, yoga, journal writing, and lunches, outside a bench, a hangout for the down and out. I played with the birds for a while, swooping down, looking to be fed. The redhead grabbed the bone left in the street. Giving it to me, I threw it to the young gull again, but climbed into my car, driving away, leaving the story behind.
Thank you. Two things that are completely different.
next piece I'm going to read is for Trish Wilson, who was planning on reading this evening but became sick. So she sent me her story. Trish is our horror and erotica writer.
Say that again? What was that?
She is our horror and erotica writer. And she joined the group after coming to the open mic one night and reading an incredibly scary story that my son still has nightmares about, after which my daughter approached her and said, "You know, my mother has a women's writing group on Wednesday mornings, and I really think you'd like it." So Trish started coming to the group. This is a piece called Like a Breath of Ocean Blue, and it appears in Best Lesbian Romance of the Year, Volume 1, available at Amazon in print and ebook format. And it's appearing under the name Elizabeth Black, which is one of Trish's pen names. There was something magical about the ocean in the height of summer. Warm air crackled around me as if the sky knew this day was going to be special. I stood by the store's back door, drinking a cup of coffee and watching the gulls bob up and down on the ocean's waves. I minded the t-shirt store Monday through Friday from 9 to 5. Today, being Friday, was a special day. My heart thundered in my chest. She'll arrive any minute. This was the first time I had interest in a woman more than merely daydreaming about her. I fingered the necklace in my pocket. Am I being too forward in giving it to her? What if she doesn't like women? I'd longed for a woman's touch for many years, but never found an opportunity until I met Malena. Malena, her name was an elixir on my lips. Malena. An orgasm in my mouth. Like a breath of ocean blue, she caught me in the pull of her riptide. Malena, whose hair fell down her back like dark rain during a midnight storm. Her sun-kissed skin glowed the color of the coffee and cream I slipped every morning. I admired her body from afar, a swell of broad hips that kissed her waist the way I wanted to, shoulders broad enough for me to rest my head upon, breasts so full I could get lost in all that delicious cleavage. How I longed for Malena, but I was too chicken-hearted to make a move. She was a virago on the waves of the churning ocean. Try as I might, I couldn't keep up with her. No one could. After all, how do you hold the wind in your hands? She slipped through, teasing, tormenting, and a light-hearted laugh burst from her supple lips each time she saw the agony she put me in. She made a deal with the owner of the shop to live upstairs while she tended the store on weekends and the summer holidays no one else wanted to work. She slept to the sound of waves crashing on the beach. I envied her. I wish I lived in a home that backed up to the ocean. I didn't know what other deals she made to have gained such a wonderful sleeping arrangement. All I knew was that I wanted her for myself. Each weekend, when she stormed into my life, I swore I would make a move on her. I flirted and blushed at her every word. I often had her favorite coffee waiting for her when she came in, black coffee with Kahlua. Sometimes I plied her with a cherry cheese Danish. She loved cherries. Each time she smiled at me with gratitude, I melted inside. She seemed to enjoy my attention, but could I be sure she wouldn't balk if I took a step further? I feared she'd recoil from me in disgust. But what if she didn't? She kept me company in the store on Fridays and Mondays, and she occasionally even helped me fold t-shirts the tourists had tossed onto a heap on the floor. The longer we kept each other company, the more I wanted her. This day, I was determined to make her my own, if only I would stop chickening out. I wore my most flattering miniskirt and my favorite white cotton blouse. I dabbed ocean-scented oil along my throat, behind my ears, between my breasts, and I smoothed it through my hair. I had to look and smell my best for when I gave Malena her big surprise. My July 4th gift to her burned a hole in my pocket. I would give it to her when the moment was right. It was an offering to a goddess in the hope that she would approve and cast upon me the affection I so desperately wanted. When she burst through the front door, it was like a zephyr had entered, disrupting even the air around her. At the sound of her laugh, my body tingled as if her honeyed voice dripped down my skin. I wanted to lick her off, slowly. "Katie, my Kate, help, I'm going to drop everything." She approached me, arms burdened with grocery store bags. I grabbed a few in one hand, carrying my coffee in the other, and followed her up the stairs. The scent of seaweed and the ocean air surrounded her as if she burst from the sea itself. Her bum swayed as she climbed the stairs. It took all my willpower to keep from reaching out and squeezing one ample cheek. The upstairs was a study in shades of cream and seafoam that offset Malena's tan. We raced to the open kitchen and dropped bags on the marble counter. She tossed food into the refrigerator pell-mell, which was her style. Milena was not a neat woman. Her life, like her spirit, was chaos. Without wasting a moment, Milena rummaged through her last bag until she found a bottle of Kahlua and a quart of heavy cream. This wasn't heavy cream from the grocery store. It was thick and mouth-watering heavy cream from a local dairy. Milena did not skimp on the second deadly sin. A treat for us, her smile brightened the already white, bright room. Kahlua for your coffee and a Kahlua and cream on ice for me. Isn't it a little early for alcohol? She touched my cheek, leaving a flame of desire on my skin in her wake. Of course it is. That's why I pour it in your coffee. The perfect breakfast pick-me-up. Without waiting for an invitation, she grabbed my coffee, removed the plastic lid, and poured in a healthy stream of Kahlua. I could make a move on her now if I wished. Embrace her after she hands me my coffee? No, I can't do this. It's better she never knows how I feel about her. I can't stay. I have to go back downstairs. Nonsense. The shop doesn't open for another hour. How long does it take you to set up? 10-15 minutes? No rush. You've locked the door, right? Yes. Then stop worrying about it. Drink. She handed my cup to me, and I sipped. The smoothness of Kahlua mellowed the bitterness of my coffee. Milena was right. A little alcohol in the morning was a lovely pick-me-up. It also calmed me down. Why not enjoy basking in her presence for an hour, even if I didn't so much as brush my hand against her cheek? How does it taste? Better? She asked. Much. Without warning, she reached up and ran her finger along the corner of my mouth. I shivered at her unexpected touch. My heart soared. Was she flirting with me? I hoped so. Some coffee got away from you. Can't have that dribbling down your chin. She smiled. At least, not about coffee. Before I could ask what she meant, she continued, I'm glad I caught you before the shop opened for the day. Do you have plans for this weekend? What could she possibly want with me? The fact that she had shown interest in my schedule enticed me. Did she want to spend time with me? My dream come true. No, I don't have any plans. I was going to go to the bonfire on the beach for July 4th, but nothing special. Why? I was so anxious for her answer, my heart nearly ceased to beat. I'm having a party and I want to invite you. Once again, she touched my cheek, but this time her touch lingered like the caress I wished it were. I've seen you here every Friday and Monday for the past 2 months, and we've danced around each other. Why is that? She cocked her head and smiled at me, making me feel warm and gooey inside. Before I could answer, she raced past me, heading for the French doors leading to the balcony overlooking the ocean. When she threw open the doors, the sound of waves crashing on the rocks below soared into the room, making my head spin with delight. Sun shone through Melania's linen miniskirt. She wore no underwear. Her ass teased me, shaped like a firm peach. My gaze traveled from her well-formed, cinnamon-toned calves up the back of her legs until I eyed the shadow of where those legs met. I wanted her. The smell of the ocean lingered around Milena and floated towards me. Here is my chance. Ah, that's better. I love the sound and the smell of the surf when I stay here, she said. I even keep the doors open during thunderstorms. There's something exciting about the crackle of static electricity in there, isn't there? There doesn't need to be a thunderstorm for this room to crackle with static electricity as long as you're standing in it, I thought. I love storms. And I'd love to come to your party. Is it here? I croaked, voice hoarse with excitement. Yes, it's tomorrow night after I close shop. I walked towards her, not wanting her to be so far away from me for even an instant. We moved onto the deck. Hot sun beat down upon my shoulders, but it couldn't rival the heat coming from Milena's body. She made me feel alive. Without needing invitation, I allowed her to place one hand on my shoulder. My entire body tingled at her touch. In such close proximity, she felt free to stare at me, her emerald gaze seeking out my soul. Her smile warmed the air around us both. I've been watching you, Katie, my Kate, and I want to ask you something. What? Would you like to spend the evening with me, just the two of us, alone? My body shook with anticipation of the meaning of her innocent words. Maybe she only wanted my company. A girl's night together, drinking Kahlua and cream, listening to the splashing surf, and basking in the summertime glow of the sun beating down upon the beach. I hoped she wanted more. Yes, I'd love to spend the evening with you. I swallowed hard and asked a leading question I hoped would spur her interest. Do you have something special in mind? I do, and I think you'd enjoy it. After all, I've seen the way you've watched me since we first laid eyes on each other. When I catch you unaware, you blush, just as you are now. She ran a finger down my cheek, bringing prickly heat to the surface. It probably glowed as red as a burn by now. Your shyness is so sweet. I love it, she said. I've taken notice of your lovely gifts of coffee and Danish, and I know they're more than courtesies of a work colleague. I may not have said a word, but I'm not naive. When she spoke, her voice was so soft I barely heard her, but her words revealed my deepest, most intimate fantasies. Her fingers weaved through my hair, pulling my head towards hers. Her eyes aflame gazed into mine, and I felt as if she touched my very soul. I know you've wanted to do this for a long time. So have I. The difference between us is I take what I want. Her lips brushed against mine, cool in the warm summer heat. I closed my eyes and lost myself in her kiss. The scent of ocean surf mingled with her crisp perfume. Lips parted and tongues danced a salsa around each other. I have never before kissed a woman. Her lips were feather soft, like pillows pressing against my own lips. So unlike a man's. Her delicate cheek brushed against my chin, so smooth. For once, a face brushed my own that was not covered with stubble. This was where I belonged, in Milena's arms, wrapped in her sumptuous curves. One thing that makes Trish's writing so wonderful is that it's often right next to the writing of another member of our group who's not here tonight, Natalie, who's doing a volumes-long project examining water in the Bible. So those two next to each other, and they offer each other some very useful comments. Yep, she's, yep. So, I was made to promise that I would read also, because much of the good of the group for me is that I also write in the group. And I'm going to read something that some of you might have heard before, but I woke up this morning wanting to smash the patriarchy after a reading in Cambridge last night, and with a particularly patriarchal poet. So I'm going to read from my letter to Maximus, which is my reaction to Charles Olson's Maximus poems, in hopes that having read it tonight, I'll be encouraged to write more of it tomorrow. Letter to Maximus. 1. I am reading your poems. It isn't that I haven't read them before, but I am reading them again, this time with care and attention and all the other words in my eyes. I am trying to make up with you, forgive you, as if you need my forgiveness. I am trying to mark the edges of your shadow so I can see where my Gloucester falls in it. Scholars can stop here. This isn't for you. 2. I am taking liberties. When the poem makes me think of the kitten we buried on 10 Pound Island because there was no land available to us at our first apartment on Mason Court, I will write about it. About how the woman downstairs wouldn't let the pregnant cat in when the storm was howling outside. About how we let her in and she gave birth, and when the storm was over, she went outside and came back with the kitten, soaking wet, too weak to nurse. We warmed it and fed it with a dropper, and it died. 3. By ear. I have listened to men talk about you more than I have listened to your words. I am sitting in Vincent Farini's house reading Catherine Bayliss's copy of the Maximus poems. I am leaving Butterick in the legal box on the daybed. 4. Born. It occurs to me just now that I was born via C-section. I wonder if my grandfather delivered me. I wonder if he delivered Charlie. My own daughter wore your granddaughter's pants to school today. This is a form I take these days. Wash, fold, cook, clean. That, too, is a form of love. 5. Love is not easy. My closest friends growing up moved away. My closest friends now came to this place from somewhere else. That is a lie. There are some from here and some who stayed, but it is not easy. 6. It is raining outside. I don't want to prove myself to you. Poetry is so much a game of one-upsmanship these days, and my list of victories is weak. I can tell you, I have cooked for and cleaned up after some of the best one-upsmen of our day. One night, I left them talking in my kitchen and went squid fishing off the state fish pier. We drank wine and ran from the big dock down to the walkways between the boats and up again. When we got home with a couple pounds of squid, they were still talking. We pulled garlic from the garden and cleaned the squid and cooked it, and we called a Norwegian cab driver to come over, and between the poets and the cab driver and the squid fishers, we each had a few bites to eat. Letter 2. Someone recently said in an argument I was part of that Maximus was a fishing poem and there didn't need to be any women in a fishing poem. She's never seen the women set up with their novenas or watched them throw confetti at St. Peter out their windows in the fort. Letter 3. Tansy. When I was young, my stepmother would lift me into the trees they had planted in the line in Stageport Park. I remember so clearly sitting there, feeling invincible and so separate from everything below me. So much tansy. There is something about riding the bus. I took the bus to and from Lanesville so often that the bus drivers still waved to me. One day, Mrs. Muncie took off all her clothes and sat naked on the bus until her stop. This rare thing, this Gloucester, is a choice we make. My children were born in Beverly. They don't deliver babies at Addison Gilbert anymore. On the day I brought my Abigail home, we walked to the top of Governor's Hill and looked out over the city, over the harbor, past the breakwater. I was so sore and tired, but I had no food in the house and didn't know what to do with the family visiting to help, so we walked up the hill with the new baby in the stroller, and we walked down the hill to Mike's to get subs. You should see the sign at Mike's. We call it Mike's because there are too many S's and the apostrophes are everywhere. I laughed when I saw Summer Sun. My first published poem outside of school was in the Summer Sun. I was a young poet, 19, I think, and you're in it. The poem, I mean. I took projective verse out of the library that summer and read it over and over before returning it to the library. It was a big summer for you, too. They put on quite a show in your honor at City Hall. Pregnant women should avoid tansy. It causes contractions, can bring on labor or abortion. It makes the mouth wet, tansy. Someone wrote some years ago about the gentrification of Gloucester because he had seen well-planted flower boxes on the houses in the fort when he was looking for your place. As if the people in the fort don't like flowers, too. I should say something here of the islands of men and girls. I hardly know what to say. Song 1. I see so much of myself in these pages. In my book that never came out, insert Corbett Wiener's joke here, I ended, words and pictures, we put them everywhere. When I say I love you, you think I am selling you soap. Song 2. This, too, the bodies, sometimes sitting still in chairs, eyelids flutter. I am in a cafe now with my own copy of your poems. I should say my husband's copy, the big book full of notes on little pieces of paper. The music here is all wrong. There should be no music. Song 3. Growing up cold, growing up not knowing how or where the other kids got their clothes, happy with the adventure every so often to the mattress shop in Rockport or the flea market in Rowley, growing up on the bus or on foot, growing up never asking, having held my babies close to keep them warm when we were out of oil, and you standing alone, fly gaping. Song 4. I don't know what takes more strength than keeping a home while the men go out and waiting, knowing they may not return, and waiting, praying for fish. Song 5. Apples. Song 6. How can we keep from singing? Letter 5 for Ariane. I had to walk away from this one. I had to walk away. If a poet pisses into the wind, I believe one can be a good writer and a good person at the same time, though some seem less concerned about this than I am. Who are you to say what Gloucester needs? I don't call myself poet any more than I call myself dishwasher or teacher or cleaner or cook, and much less than lover or mother or daughter or friend. I put as much care into a pot of soup as I put into a poem. On Thursday mornings, I work with children turning their words into poems. More often than not, they say, I love Mama. Maybe what this island of men and girls needs, maybe what this city has when poets posture and men go out to sea is mothers.
Thank you. And next up we have our man.
I am Joe. I brought my crutch. I have a job. Thank you. want to thank Amanda, too, for hosting and this night and this class. It's been a really nice outlet for me and helped a lot. And I've learned a lot more than I did in an English class at a music school. First, I have a poem called The Memories You Left Behind. The memories you left behind, sliced with razors into sections, pulled with needle-nose pliers, spackled, sanded, scraped, and painted over. Years of glue blasted off with machines. Bare parquet smothered with coats of chemicals by Vietnamese men from Boston. The piece of plaster fits just right now. The two pipes are sealed with a blowtorch now. No one will know you lived here 23 years unless I tell them. And this is called YouTube. Joe, you're not making any sense. My 14-year-old guitar student was laughing at me, and he had a point. I can admit I'm not doing a great job of conveying my feelings. I just don't get it. It's not musical. Of course it's musical. It's a guy playing music. I know, but he's alone in a room. Does he have a band or any friends to jam with? Isn't he lonely? We're just playing the guitar. It's the two of us, alone in a room. How's it any different? It's different. He's alone in a room making a video for people to watch alone in a room. A video for everybody and nobody. Every part of the process is isolated now. I remember when I was your age, the guy from the band Kicked in the Head was walking around the crowd during the song, and he stuck the horn of his trombone right in my face, man. And I have this memory of violent music daring me to do something with my life, to be a part of something bigger. Your guy, he's just all alone, and it makes me sad to watch. He's not even playing a song. He's just playing notes on a guitar. Yeah, but he's really good. Yeah, he's really good. All right, and I like to think that I'm here to every week with Amanda so I can write songs, and this is a song that I wrote. It's called I Never Shot Heroin. Never shot heroin. Never shot heroin. Done so much wrong, I feel a need for confession. I don't know where to begin. Told so many lies. Look straight into your eyes. I gritted my teeth, and you heard what you wanted to believe. Used to steal. It was so long ago that it barely seems real. You take a dollar, and no one's around. The tree hits the ground. Still makes a sound and leaves a black mark you forever feel. Not chasing a high. A nice little buzz is enough to get by. I wonder why I can't live my life like the rest of the hive. Never shot heroin. Never shot heroin. I've done so much wrong, I feel the need to confess it in a song to the world. Thanks.
Rehearsal tonight is also part of the women's group and often graces us with her beautiful voice singing songs to the ukulele that she's written in the class. And it's wonderful to have the combination of music and words as part of our Wednesday morning. Next up, we have Maureen Cusumato, who is has been a member of this writing group longer than me.
This is the divorce. Sammy sat on her on the window seat in her bedroom, staring at the raindrops splashing against the window. Slowly, tears began to run down her face. She could no longer hold them back. 6 months ago, she was a happy teenager living in Virginia. Sammy and her friends anxiously anticipating the next phase of their lives that would begin with the start of high school in the fall, the boys, the dances, and the courses that would help steer them to the college or career of their dreams. That was before. Before my parents turned my life upside down when they announced their decision to divorce, a decision made without even asking me or my younger brother how we felt about breaking up their family, our family. My father moved out and had little time left for me or Duke. His new girlfriend Sally seemed to take up most of his time. My mom was devastated by the breakup. She began going out a lot to drown her sorrows. This left me and Duke to fend for ourselves. Neither mom or dad seemed to notice that Duke and I were affected just as severely or more from the divorce. I had always been able to depend on my parents to be supportive of my extracurricular activities or just a voice to listen when life got tough. All of that changed overnight. I was struggling with feelings of abandonment, loneliness, and betrayal for the first time in my life. I didn't have the support I needed. I was left to figure it out on my own. The next blow came when my mother decided out of the blue to sell the family home. She also informed us that at the end of the school year, we would be moving to New Hampshire to live with our grandmother. I had always loved our summer visits to Grandma's house with my parents. I never dreamed of moving up north permanently. It was hours away from my dad, my friends, my home. Why didn't anyone ask me what I wanted? Instead of looking forward to starting high school with my friends, I was dreading the start of a new school year in a new town with no friends. I begged my father to let me stay with him. His answer was to tell me it was best for me to go with my mother to New Hampshire. Best for who? My father promised to call and to visit often. I had little hope of this since we lived in the same town and Duke and I seldom heard from him. He was always working or busy with his new girlfriend. He wanted us to get to know her. Why do I need to get to know her? She has all of his free time. Why can't he ever find time to spend with me and Duke alone? Sally is nice enough, but she isn't my mother and never will be. If she would just go away, my dad would come back home. We would be a family again. I could start high school here, like I'm supposed to, with all my friends. Mom wouldn't sell the house, and our trip to New Hampshire would be a vacation. Well, that didn't happen. We moved to New Hampshire to live with Grandma. Finally, there was an adult that was there all the time while Mom was working and dating desperately, trying to find a replacement for Dad. Why aren't Duke and I enough? Grandma seemed to be the only one that understood how I was feeling. She often talked to me while I was helping her around the house. She even tried to introduce me to my girls my own age, but I was determined not to make friends. I wasn't ready to let go of my anger. I wanted my old friends, my old home, and I wanted my dad to come back. Grandma told me she was grateful to have Duke and I to help around this big old house. She mentioned she was thinking of selling her house. It was just too much for her to take care of. I felt bad because I secretly wished she had sold it and moved to Virginia with us. Late at night, I sometimes think up plans to run away and flee back to Virginia. Mom would never notice I was gone, and if I just showed up on my father's doorstep, he would have to take me in. Sometimes I plan to secretly hide out at a friend's house. Certain Mom and Dad wouldn't care enough to look for me. In the end, I knew it would hurt Grandma. I felt as if she was the only one that needed or wanted me, so I stuck it out another day for her. And one more thing, I want to thank Amanda and the Writer Center for making this group possible. Thank you.
have Miss Roberta. Bobby Wayne.
I had to get it.
I'm teasing her. She will.
You'll never know when it's coming.
I'm excited now.
Excuse me. I brought a stand so that I can stand up. And I even brought a light so that I can see. And I even brought glasses so I can read. So this is a story about the gig from hell. Because like Joe and Renee and Hillary and other people in the room, I started out as a performer. I play the harp and I'm a singer-songwriter. But I also write these songs. And this is about one of those gigs that performers all have at some point. It's called A Jersey Club Date. The bustier was a metallic phosphorescent blue. Butterfly wings, I thought, as I fastened the hooks and eyes which closed the back seam. It fit like a second skin. It was fashioned corset-like around 6 lightweight vertical plastic ribs, 2 in back, 2 on each side, and 2 in front, running from the waistline up over the center of each breast. The gossamer fabric stretched gracefully from rib to rib in a U-shape and was pulled taut across my cleavage. I viewed myself in the bathroom mirror. All that exposed flesh was crying out for a necklace, but a necklace might knock against the harp. After all, I thought, I don't want my clothing to interfere with a performance. Dress in the folky coffee houses where Dan, my guitar player, and I were used to playing was not a big deal. Jeans, maybe skirts or long dresses for the women were de rigueur. Sexy was not ordinarily a word one would choose to describe performers' garb at these venues. I pulled on my black spandex miniskirt and stepped into a pair of sparkly heels. Dan gave a low whistle. Whoa, you're hot. I smiled back at him while applying my makeup. But do I look like a pop star? I worried, pinning my long ringlets of hair up in the back, allowing several curls to fall provocatively along my cheek. At least I wouldn't be seated trapped with my harp in between my legs. Lately, I had begun standing to play, placing the harp atop a wooden box. This gave me freedom of movement, which would really pay off at this particular gig. Dan and I had been a duo for 7 years since we had met performing with the Hudson River Sloop Singers, a group of performers who raised money to support the environmental work of the Sloop Clearwater. We had played at riverside festivals, aboard ships in New York City's harbor, on the radio, TV, countless Unitarian church-run coffee houses, in bars, and theaters and house concerts. Dan had the day job. It fell to me to do the booking. We had developed a roster of regular venues to which we added gigs whenever possible. I must have discovered this new club ahead of my folky colleagues as I was the first to get a booking. It had not been a hard sell. Following up a few weeks after having sent our promo package, I called the club. Me. Hi, this is Bobby Wayne. I mailed you a demo last week and I wanted to see if you had a chance to play it yet. Kenny. Yeah, I gave your demo a listen. You guys are good. Let me tell you a little about our club. You know, we're a new venue. We're going for a broad range of performers. He then proceeded to rattle off all the performers he planned to book, musicians at various degrees of fame. I held the phone to my ear, waiting, planning my pitch. Kenny, blah, 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 and so, and so, and so, and Whitney Houston. That got my attention. Me, swallowing hard. So, Kenny, your club is more of a pop venue? Kenny, exactly. Let me stop right here before you have a chance to ask, what on earth made you think the two acoustic musicians playing folk music on a harp and guitar would appeal to an audience of Whitney Houston fans? I have to say, honestly, I didn't. The cardinal rule in the arts is if you're asked whether or not you can do something and there's a paycheck in it, you say without hesitation, yes. You can work it out later. Kenny rattled on, enthusiastically mentioning his state-of-the-art sound system. He seemed excited about booking us. We struck a deal. Dan and I struggled over our set list. I composed most of our songs and instrumentals. My taste was notoriously eclectic. For example, You Can't Find a Bathroom in the City of New York was Patter's song, a la Gilbert and Sullivan. At the other extreme was The Vines, a dark, classical-sounding art song I had written in Russian, which would have fit right in at Carnegie Recital Hall. Interspersed with instrumentals were ironic topical songs like I'm Going to Win the Reader's Digest Sweepstakes and Les Femmes Chaussées, my own version of the high-heeled shoes history beginning with Cro-Magnon Woman. We augmented our shows with songs written by friends like Marcy Boyd's hysterically racy take on contemporary lovemaking, Celibacy, and Chris Lavin's Don't Ever Call Your Sweetheart by His Name. Normally, we would throw only a few of these songs in each set, surrounded by traditional folk music, as harpers were expected to play the beautiful and ancient Celtic harp repertoire. With a relatively conservative world of people who had taken up the neo-Celtic harp in the 1980s, I was something of a black sheep, my music beyond the pale. Now, finally, we were playing for a young, sophisticated audience that would appreciate my ironic humor. We, I told my reflection with confidence, will pull out all the stops. I batted my eyelashes and vamped. They will love us. Dan gave me his blank look. We loaded the car and drove the short distance from our Nyack, New York apartment to the Garden State Parkway. According to my directions, the club was somewhere here near Princeton. I hope the traffic won't be too heavy, I fretted. A club like this, you know, a large venue with a big sound system, we gotta have a good sound check. Dan nodded in agreement. As the sun began to set, the traffic's headlamps became a river of light, each vehicle a boat rushing along, pulled by an unseen current. I leaned my forehead against the car's window and watched the suburbs streak by, the warmth of streetlights and the cool bluish TV screens alternating in the darkness like the frames of a silent movie. Above the tree line, an orange glow obliterated the stars. Turning off the highway, Dan followed a road, which quickly became a two-lane street. Our directions indicated that we should be only blocks from this venue. This can't be right, I said. They wouldn't have a club in the middle of a neighborhood. Well, here's the street, Dan announced. Right here, he turned into the parking lot of an alarmingly gothic-shaped building. Ignition off, we sat silently in the darkness, letting reality set in. The night was filled with chirping of late summer's crickets. I squared my shoulders, pulled my miniskirt lower on my thighs, and opened the door. I had on a light jacket, but the night air felt chilly on my inadequately covered body. Dan unloaded the instruments and our gear while I went inside what was undeniably both Kenny's club and an Episcopalian church. Lights were on only in the basement, so we lugged everything down the stairs. I entered a long meeting room filled with rows of metal folding chairs. Bookshelves lined a wall. At one end was a kitchen. A pulpit stood at the other. There was no stage in sight. I could not imagine Whitney Houston playing here. Oh, hi, said a man, popping his head through the doorway. He was juggling several microphone stands. This was Kenny. With the greatest difficulty, he began to set up the sound system, 3 microphones, a small soundboard, and a couple of speakers. The sound man was, of course, Kenny himself. I drew a long breath. Celtic harps are difficult instruments to amplify, even with the best equipment. I stuck my pickup on the harp soundboard, knowing there was always the possibility of it popping off if I bumped the wire. Having a pickup permanently installed was not within the bounds of my budget. Neither could I afford a headset mic. I always had to use the club's mic. This, too, was problematic, as the stand would be in the way of my arms. I needed a boom to hold the vocal mic. Not designed for harps, this mic could easily be hit when reaching for my bass strings. The harp
on top of the box presented a visual challenge. Leaning against my right shoulder, it partially blocked the view of the audience. To simultaneously see both the strings and Dan on my right, I had to turn my face without going off mic. Kenny's equipment did not include monitors, which we needed to hear each other properly. Despite his lack of equipment, Kenny was struggling to set up what he had. People began arriving while he dashed from one end of the hall to the other, fiddling with switches and wires. I watched, open mouth, still wearing my jacket. Who knows, I told Dan. This close to the city, the audience could actually be edgy, right? Dan was staring at the ceiling, looking for an escape hatch. Just then we heard Kenny, who was also the club's MC, announce us. Take off your jacket, hissed Dan. We gaily entered through the kitchen door, making our way up the center aisle past rows of nattily dressed, silver-haired people. Polite throat clearing. I discreetly tried yanking my bustier higher and my skirt lower. Lifting my harp onto its box, I turned, smiling my most appealing smile. We launched into a flashy tango. Spotlights make most stages overly warm, but we were in a chilly basement lit by recessed ceiling lights. The audience wisely wore sport coats, slacks, and turtleneck sweaters. Can they see my fingers trembling? I wondered. No, their eyes are too busy alternating between my neckline and my hemline. Genteel applause at the tango's ending. Okay, so Kenny lied through his teeth about this being a pop venue, I thought wildly as I introduced the next song. So what if they weren't used to our repertoire? I tuned a few strings which had gone flat in the damp basement air. Dan and I began a satirical song about unrequited love. I sensed through the unspoken connection that goes on between performers on stage that Dan was sharing my rising sense of panic. From the bemused faces of the audience, we knew it would be a rough evening. We have to, I thought, either grin them down or abruptly change our set and wing it, playing traditional pieces we haven't practiced. The second song came to an end, more lukewarm applause. Introducing the third piece, I simultaneously muttered to Dan, "This isn't working. We're holding back. We got to ramp it up." I had written a rap song called Don't Eat Your Own Species. In past shows, it always drew cheers and applause. As I tore into it, my body rocking with the beat, the harp began bouncing off my bustier like a person on a trampoline. It gained velocity with each bounce, lurching aggressively towards the audience. I could feel my spandex miniskirt inching its way up my thighs. Each time the harp rocked back toward my body, I snatched at the skirt's hem with my right hand, causing the harp to wobble dangerously atop the box on which it stood. I tried getting a grip on the harp's forward pillar. Wham! My elbow hit the mic with a loud bang. The audience rose from their seats like a wave, but was too polite to make a break for it. Perhaps they were waiting to see what would happen next. They settled back down, wary and wide-eyed. As my movements became increasingly frantic, I grinned harder through gritted teeth, trying to appear in control of my bouncing harp and my wardrobe. This is like playing harp atop a galloping stallion, where I've lost both the reins and the stirrups, I thought as I struggled. I was dimly aware of Dan on my right, grimly banging out the rhythm on the guitar. What a trooper. We dared not make eye contact. The microphone's feedback caused the audience to wince and clap their hands over their ears. Dan kept signing to Kenny to turn down the volume, but Kenny had his own agenda. No sooner would we start another tune than Kenny would manipulate the soundboard, throwing off our balance and the speakers. Mercifully, at the intermission, while Kenny was busy selling refreshments from the kitchen, Dan unplugged the sound system. After hastily conferring, Dan and I played a folky second set full of tried and true oldies, Irish harp tunes, and sing-alongs, which we performed to our relieved, if now reduced, audience. The harp stood squarely on the floor. I played sitting on a chair, gripping my instrument between my knees, wearing a jacket over my bustier. We did not use any sound equipment. No one complained of our not being a pop act. All the Whitney Houston fans had probably gone home. You're welcome.
And our final reader tonight. Yeah, Hillary. Mm-hmm. Hillary, who literally found us one morning.
I did. That's like a whole other. I wrote about that. I think I did. I read about that the last time. All right.
You were passing through on your way from New Hampshire.
No, I got kicked out of the Beverly Farms library for falling asleep, which is not called falling asleep when you're a writer. It was called kind of collecting myself. I also want to thank Amanda. I thank you a little bit in the second piece that I read. It was sort of tribute to you. But this place is just such a beautiful respite place to go. My son used to go to school down here, so I'd commute like a crazy person. And then I was like, that's crazy. I'm not going to commute to bring my son to school. And you all were like, well, bye, Hillary. We'll miss you. Come back sometime. I'm like, oh, no, I'm still commuting on Wednesdays. I literally drop my child off in Elliott, Maine, and get here by, 9:15. And then, Bobby, you mentioned that I have a background in theater, but I long ago gave that up, and I work in the healing arts now, and I work in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and it's important for the context of what I'm going to tell you that I am an energy medicine practitioner, so I literally work in the metaphysical realm of healing at a general practice, so I get referrals from doctors, nurses. I have my clients are surgeons, the children of surgeons. It's pretty cool. World, but it's filled with something called HIPAA, which is the opposite of the Gloucester Writer Center, where you can't talk about anything, and you hold it in your heart. So I come down here as a gift, as a gift to me, and I thank you all for being here, for you guys for welcoming me, and for you for being here tonight to listen to all of us. And then I always heard, my husband's a photographer, and I always heard you should title your photograph based on the one thing missing from the photograph. That's not necessarily true for writing, but for tonight, both of what I have to, I'm going to title what's pertinent that's not in it. And it's pertinent to know that this piece is a little autobiographical moment that happened. You need to know it did not happen this year. It happened the summer before this past summer. You'll see my political pop references come up right away. It was too hot to sit outside, but too cold at the Massachusetts General Hospital cafeteria. Want to sit out here? I suggested to Dick, my client of 8 years. Once a week, we talk at 8:15 p.m. I was hired to be his energy medicine intuitive. In our first appointment, I told him he has a block across his chest separating his heart from his head. I felt crazy saying it out loud. I always do, but it's my job. So I said it, and he said, "How did you know that about me?" And I said, "I didn't. It's just there and needs to go away." He's my Tuesday night phone call for almost a decade now, for sharing and healing. We meet on the phone. Dick is the son of an Armenian man who survived the Holocaust. When his father was only 14 years old, he was forced to walk for punishment. It's called the Death March, to lose everything and then be forced to walk. This man survived on the mercy of a Turkish soldier who not only handed him a handful of nuts, but also instructed him to eat only one nut a day to make them last, not to waste any peace. He survived and moved to America, and now his son is 82 years old, and we are far away from the death march on this sunny hospital courtyard. Our table was only half shaded by the building. The tuna fish sandwich that I purchased, well, he purchased, at the checkout, was so much more delicious outside with the fishiness of Boston's air at 95 degrees. We'd go back inside soon. We were there to strategize with the oncologist. to jointly interrogate the prestigious doctor to see if he could admit that he wasn't doing enough to combat lung cancer. But we still had time. "What's your husband thinking about Trump up there in New Hampshire?" his Cheshire grin and Danny DeVito voice asked me out of the blue. God, could he possibly take this conversation further away from stage four cancer, I wondered. "Up in New Hampshire, we wait as long as possible before we talk politics." I didn't bite. "Really? First in the nation." He's skeptical by nature. "Excuse my French," I played along, "but the shit show that will arrive soon enough, and when it's all over, we are still going to be in the same place back at the beginning with neighbors, friends, and family. Can't get too distracted by that attention." Dick said, "I think he's fabulous." "Really?" I finally bit. "Yep, he's no fool. You can't navigate that kind of wealth in New York City for decades, and he's not even Jewish." I noticed how delicious my sandwich tasted. I was hungry. I smiled and chewed and heard words like immigration and menstruation and Megyn Kelly and knew this was the best elixir to the cancer talk we were supposed to be preparing for. I laughed about bleeding from wherever as I fed my crust to approaching birds and turned curiously when an ambulance pulled up onto the curb behind us. I felt the hot sun and wondered about skin cancer and what the bald woman at the next table was thinking about. Then I gazed at her well-behaved dog just by her feet and thought, that's not the type of dog they allow inside of hospitals. Is she just sitting here with no reason to go inside? "He's no fool," Dick continued. "Trump's going to beat the pack, the whole pack." Why is he so feisty about this candidate on this day? I was anxious. It's like an anxious monologue, and he needed to throw him a lifeline. No, I needed to throw him a lifeline. No, I needed to throw myself a lifeline, I wondered. I thought, "Hey, Dick." I overtly interrupted. He knew it, and he smiled. "You know what I like to do sometimes in situations like this?" "Yeah?" He smiled again. "Like what situations?" "Like now. I'm noticing these small birds walking up to our table. That dog over there, the way this courtyard is made of cobblestone, I like to pretend I'm somewhere else, like we're someplace far away." I knew by his short breath he wanted to keep talking about Trump, but I know Dick well enough, and I threw him an idea he couldn't refuse. "Look around," I said. "It's true with the sights and the smells and the bustling up around us. It's Paris. We could be in Paris. We just need a baguette and a bottle of wine. I reach for my crust, and we might as well be sitting in the heart of France." I stopped and watched him. It was time to go inside soon. The shade now covered our table, and I was full and happy and wanted to stay right where we were. Dick looked past me and then over to the dog. He reached across to his plate. Could be, he agreed as he joined in, throwing his crust to the birds at our feet. And this one I actually did title based on how you title a photograph. This one, one of the great things about our writing group is what we talk about in between, before, and after the writing. And when we were having a discussion a week ago about what we were going to, you know, read, I was like, I want to read this, but I'm going to need to edit it. So this is titled, "I was going to edit the seventh line and then thought better of this on this week of October of 2016. The group, but, okay, I have to get ready for this. The group got edgier this summer. It's not just the heat, but it's time itself sharpening us as writers, as thinkers, as we contemplate the word pussy versus vagina in August. Well, in July, we debated the symbol of clouds in the Bible, records from sacred text that reference sacred water droplets. We contemplate. then back at home in Dover, New Hampshire, that very next Sunday, can you believe, Pastor Bennett, at a new church I decided to find after my mom died. This church is really only new for me because in the year 1623, the church and the town began. But just last Sunday, in 2016, this pastor spoke of parishioners gathering like droplets in faith, like a cloud. Hebrew something. I wanted to write it down. I should have. I didn't. To share with my writer friends on this edge of Cripple Cove. In our cloud. To pen it down. On a page. To read. To vent. To riff. Sharpening like a knife. Like a razor. Like the edge in the story I heard in my office of the dog. My client witnessed falling off a cliff while on a family hike. A misstep on four legs. I thought dogs didn't make such mistakes. Only children in fog or rain when the parents are fighting or photographing or sitting to let the blood flow back into their middle-aged feet, not watching. But she witnessed. And this is a true story. The family up front, the dog fell and died. She was hiking and she was torn by empathy, horror, and then surged with protection. Because she ran back with her own dog all the way back to the car, because who knows what led that first dog over the edge. The dog running back to the car is named Panda. Panda could fall too. Her angry daughter felt abandoned, up on the edge without her mom. The daughter is hopefully 14 by now, a year closer to her true 30-year-old self. When I say she's a beauty pageant contestant, I mean she came in second at Miss Teen New Hampshire. But if she keeps competing, she could really be somebody, the daughter told me. She's already planning on breast implants. You haven't even stopped growing, I say. Oh, I think I have, she dimmed her face at me. Oh, girl, you're still growing. That was 2 months ago. Now she's here for an eating disorder, and she didn't give a shit about the dead dog, her words. Mom overreacts, mom cries on a dime, her words. I can still see the dog on the rock, family hauling up the body for dignity, for closure, for something to do to make the shock go somewhere. I can't unsee the dead dog, mom's words. Me neither. Maybe 2 or 3 weeks from now, like I've unseen the rapes, the drowned toddler, the car crashes, the motorcycle accident that took his speech but left his humor. The sight softens into truth. Truth is what it is that moment, not the trauma truth of something that happened, or the drama truth of the could-be what-ifs. The truth requires patience. I wait. And listen, no other way to manage. No other way to heal. It's called vicarious stress. You listen enough, you start to think you're living it, the teacher told me. Vicarious stress tricks this brain into thinking it's happened to you. You see it, and you live it subconsciously, vicariously. I need thick boundaries, a lighter place to listen. So the ukulele songs play while the winter cap is being crocheted with Pete Seeger stories. He died, you know. I didn't know he died until Bobby told us he was one of her friends. Seeger is one of those American stars we take for granted. Just always going to be there saying what no one else will. Bravery. Amanda knits. She infused a succinct wisdom poetically. The pile of words that spill into our circle, because I've never seen a square cloud. Takes form as she knits yarn and people and ideas and words into a shape, the shape of a writing group. I feel courage in this room. I want to rip back my head and bellow in horror and glory. How scary this is to write it down, to run away and to run towards something at the very same time. I'm tattooed with rules I made before I understood the permanency. The writing doesn't wait. But these writers, we wait for each other. To come around again. To a Wednesday. To begin again. I drive to these windmills like three regal daisies looking outward and waving across Cape Ann. In every rotation, their blades repeat, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you all so much for reading, for listening, and now we get to eat cake.
That you made! Cake!